Welcome to a very special quarantine episode of What a Waste of Time. If you're self-isolating that out there, I hope you're doing okay and we can help waste a bit of your time, maybe.
Wash your hands. And don't go outside. Talk to your elders.
We had hoped to do a podcast with Callum, but we can't see him because he doesn't live here.
In quarantine. That's the main reason.
We would invite him over.
Yeah. He's a friend of the show still.
Yeah.
Who's this talking?
Yes, it's me, Jim. And I'm here with my good friend, Nick.
Yeah, you said the
who does live with me.
I do.
I forgot about you.
It's a quarantine, Jim. It's getting to us all.
So, yeah, this is sort of unplanned, because we were starting... So, another historic thing that happened over the course of this weekend was that Steven Universe ended.
And hold it right there, listener. We're not going to talk about spoilers, or at least we're going to be very, very careful and flag any spoilers that do come up, but I don't think they will.
Oh, really? Because I was going to be like, oh yeah, we're going to spoil the shit out of it.
Oh, okay, that's fine. You know, I don't think, I feel like that the topic that I was expecting to talk about isn't necessarily about any of the specifics of the plot.
Yeah, we might be, well, nah, I bet.
It only came out yesterday, so I'm just wondering, I don't know when you're going to put this out. Like, the coronavirus could be over by then. It's not. It's not.
If a big spoiler comes up, we'll flag it.
Good.
So we're going to start the timing out.
Doop-a-doop, here we go.
So I guess we were starting to talk about it because we were starting to discuss like certain things that we might have liked to see in the show, which we now never will because it's over. And basically how, like, but then different reaction to that, like, because I mentioned certain things, it's like, oh, yeah, this would have been interesting, but I understand that the story is based in, like, Steven's perspective and Steven's emotional journey, so I'm not surprised that the show didn't expand in that way.
For me, I feel this podcast isn't necessarily about Steven Universe specifically. I think it's more about media interpretation, because the thing that I was saying, and you suddenly went, is this a podcast? is this a cast? And we rushed upstairs and got all the mics out and started recording, is the different ways that we prioritize stuff within a narrative and how much weight we give to it.
Mm.
Because very tiny baby thing about the Steven Universe finale, the chest that is in Rose's lion, we're never going to find out what was in there. And I don't care. I never cared. It wasn't a thing that interested me. But a lot of people on the internet seem upset, and I don't necessarily understand why.
Well, is that true? Because I know I've seen like some people reacting to it. I don't know if upset is the right term, unless you've seen different reactions to me.
I've seen people be all like, "Ugh, what a missed opportunity! We'll never know what's in the chest." And I'm "It's a what do you think is in there? I mean, like, who cares?"
So we were discussing like I guess a little closer to that than you are, because like the example you brought up earlier is so very early on in the show Steven Universe, there I think it's the episode was Sirius Steven. They go inside a magical pyramid, and there's a mural on the wall of the pyramid that implies certain events in the history of the show that have not yet been revealed. And at the time, I got a bit obsessed with that mural.
You got very Charlie from It's Always Sunny. You were Pepe de Silvio everywhere.
Can we talk about the mural? I just want to talk about the mural. and it turns out, like, I don't think there was as much in that mural as maybe I had believed at the time, but it did at least...
You got a lot out of it.
Yeah.
You had a great time.
It did imply certain things that turned out to be true. I think they just they had a sort of a few paragraphs about the history of the world that they then made the mural of and then expanded on that history later. Mm. And
whereas I looked at that mural once and went, "Oh, neat," and then Jim occasionally would go, "Nick, I think it's this." I went, "Maybe," and that's as much as I thought about it, because in the way that Jim thinks about writing, both in terms of the things that he enjoys and the things that he creates. As I'm going to repeat myself from downstairs.
It's all right, they weren't there, so they didn't know what you said.
Jim likes to construct elegant puzzle box narratives that are full of detail, depth of study and complicated interlocking mechanical mechanisms whereby you can see all of the neat clockwork ticking together, and it's very satisfying.
Mm.
That is not what I, one, really enjoy to read that much. And not, no disrespect to your work, of course, but like, it's not the kind of thing that I'm drawn to, and it's not the kind of stuff that I create. When I write stuff, it tends to be much more rooted in raw emotional momentum. Mm. Like, this is one of the reasons why I love shitty teens, because shitty teenagers have immense amounts of emotional energy, and it just drives and chemically reacts and explodes everywhere. And that's the stuff that really, like, makes me go, yeah, let's see what's happening here. It's like, with Steven Universe, I was always more drawn into, rather that I was interested to a certain extent with, like, the mystery of who Rose Quartz really was, mm, or whatever, as a person. But for me, it was less about the revelation of the mystery and the aha moment.
Yeah.
And more about the, how that emotional impact affected the characters and how it changed the dynamics of their relationships, mm, which I think is a subtle-ish difference, but I think somewhat key in terms of how I choose to interpret the stuff that I read. Because I don't... I think in some ways, I think I'm more willing to be more flexible in terms of narrative structure than you are, maybe? Potentially, I think. I may be projecting.
But I mean, I think that is true, but I mean, not... It's not that I don't want to characterize myself as inflexible, and I certainly don't want to say that like the things you just described don't interest me either.
I like a lot of dumb shit.
You do like a lot of dumb shit.
Like, I do, and it's like the dumb is the appeal.
Good, I mean, that's a good way of, like, because I can be quite snobbish about dumb shit. Hmm. And
doesn't like Pacific Rim.
I don't mind.
Objectively incorrect.
But then, the thing that bothered me about, and I don't know, like, because you could, like, maybe this is a structural criticism, or it could also be, in a, like, a criticism of the, like, the emotional journey in it, because my big thing of it is that I didn't like the main character, and I thought that, I've forgotten her name, begins with an
Mako.
M. Mako. I thought that her story was much more interesting, and she should have been the protagonist.
I agree. I don't disagree with anything that you've said there.
But the difference there is that that was enough for me to be nope, this doesn't do it for me.
Mm.
Whereas like because there's other things where I'm like, oh yes, that's a valid criticism, but it doesn't spoil it for me.
Yeah,
which I guess is what
pick
you're
a
like
season with of Doctor Who, and there's probably something where you could be like, ugh, but still, I'm still here. I'm not asking you to do that necessarily now.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
The thing that interests me about this topic, which is, I think, why it prompted a discussion, is that, for me, I can't think of an example of something where there has been something on the level of the minutiae,
mm,
of the level of something like, for example, Rose's chest.
Yeah.
lads. I can't think of an example of something that is on that level that has actually made me be like, well, this was less enjoyable. Like, I really wish I'd found out blank. Because it's very seldom about the finding out of blank.
Yeah.
It's, for me, it's more about, well, what does the main character care about? And are they there? Because ultimately, to use the example of Steven Universe, Steven doesn't care what's in the chest. I mean, in the fiction of the show, he probably knows what's in the chest.
Yeah.
It's just a bunch of whatever.
I mean, yeah, the only time that, you know, he's come up against the chest is where, I'm just going to give some, like, some mid-season details. Like, he had one brush in with the chest, but then the result of that episode was that it was not important.
Yeah. And if Steven doesn't care, as a reader, I'm like, well, why should I care?
Mm.
Why should I be interested in a thing that the show, well, the characters in the show and also the show itself, clearly isn't really that invested in. And I understand that there's the completionist aspect of media.
Yeah.
Of like, you know, you do, if you really love a show, well, that's a bit sort of, that's a value judgment there. If you're very invested in a show, it's only natural that you might want to find out every part of it and really know it and understand it and sort of be like, yes, I have done all of the relevant legwork to sort of ingratiate myself and invest into the show. And like, that's maybe is how people invest in a thing. Because, like, for example, a thing that worked for me really well and didn't work for you very well was the manga series Ao no Flag, which is a slow... It was the gay, shitty teen manga that you read, like, the first five chapters of or whatever.
I expunged it all from my memory.
Well, there we go. The thing about that is that, one, it was a slow burn, but it was also all about... There was no mysterious thing. Mm. It was pretty much just a cauldron of hormonal teenage angst and queer anxiety. And that was it. That was the whole thing. And for me, I was like, this is great. Everyone's miserable, but having, like, quite complicated and, like, but... They articulated in a way that was sort of eloquent, but still authentically of the teenage voice. And the reason I wanted you to try, was quite sort of, Jim, you should really try this, is because I was like, I felt that maybe that particular cauldron of emotional stuff, even though it is a slow burn, might be enough to get you in. But I think looking back on it now, I'm like, well, it's very unstructured. Like, it's like teenagers. Sometimes it just does stuff because sometimes teenagers just do stuff.
Yeah.
And it's less about the smooth execution of a thing, you know, which I think is a thing that you, not necessarily the only thing that you prize in the way that you have a narrative, but it's a thing that you value.
Definitely when I'm starting something new, I'm looking for, well, why am I reading this? Especially because it might be because you're a much, much faster reader than I am. so me reading anything is already an investment of my time. There's been...
I've always got that copy of Infinite Jest set in my room that I'm never going to read. That's the thing. It's like, what should I read? Anything else. Just anything else. Doesn't matter.
But I'm definitely, like, I do enjoy a nicely structured plot, even if it isn't a puzzle box. It's like, oh yes, this works very well. This is doing very efficient things. Mm. I do like a mystery, because that does draw me in. Mm. I do like the aha moment, and I'm very... very aware that the aha moment means nothing if it doesn't mean anything to the characters, which is why, coming into the whole, who is Snoke really question? It's just like, well, if he's Darth Plagueis the Wise, who the fuck cares? It's like, so, yeah, so I was never interested in that question. But then also, if we're on Star Wars again...
I mean, you brought us in, yeah, so...
One thing that, lots of people read into The Force Awakens that Rey's parents were significant.
Hmm.
And I did not read that from The Force Awakens.
Yeah.
I could certainly see that, like, oh, that thread was left hanging for a future writer to maybe pick it up. But the only question, like, about the backstory to this film that I thought that J.J. Abrams, like, genuinely raised was, how did Maz Kanata get Luke's Skywalker? In that...
You mean Luke's lightsaber?
Yes.
You said Luke Skywalker. Luke
Skywalker. I was so worried I wouldn't be able to remember Maz Kanata's name. That's all I was thinking of. Maz Kanata, but Finn, like, actually asks that question. Like, why do you have this? And Maz Kanata says, a good question for another time. And I find it interesting that nobody latched onto that question. Because that was the only one that the story, in very explicit terms, raised. And all the questions that they did latch onto were sort of ones that were implication, or just, like, things that could be something, or it's like, oh, like, because of the history of Star Wars, parents are always significant, so this began looking, oh, how do these new characters connect to old characters?
See, this is the thing. In the same way, I didn't really care who Rey's parents were.
Mm.
But I cared about the question because it mattered to Rey. Because if you just look at The Force Awakens in isolation, that character is looking for structure, a home, and a father figure.
Yes.
She latches onto Han Solo very obviously, of just like, you're my dad now! And I was just like, oh, she is looking for her place in the world, and knowing where she came from is a fundamental part of figuring out what that place is.
Mm.
For me, though, is that a lot of people then took that of like, okay, this is an important question to Rey, therefore the answer must be important to us, the readers. Which is where you got that she's a Kenobi, she's a senior Skywalker, turns out she was Palpatine's granddaughter of his sex-having clone!
Oh, dear.
You know, yeah, terrible. But the thing is, I did not ever conflate the idea that what is significant to Rey has to be significant to the universe. Because for me, it was about that emotional journey. And what Last Jedi did really well for me is that they answer the question, just say, yeah, it doesn't matter. Like, they weren't anybody significant. You've always kind of known that you weren't special. And you had this brief flirtation of maybe your place in the universe is a preordained, dynasty-ridden existence where you are one of the three major families who controls all of... the galaxy.
Well, yeah, that's when we were queuing to go into that film. Our friend of the show, Rob.
Hey, Rob.
He asked me who I thought Ray's parents were, and I'd never properly considered the question until then. And I said, you know what? I hope that they are nobody. I just thought that is the because that is the most interesting answer to that question for Ray.
Yeah, a good answer is to pose a difficult and powerful question, and then from a writing standpoint, like, what I would then do is if I've got a character with a question, then I either want to come up with an answer that is either not what they hope it is, because that generates conflict.
Yes.
So in which case, the Palpatine answer is technically more correct than a Skywalker or a Kenobi, in that sense. Or it's, like, something that the answer is not the actual answer to... Well, the answer to that question is not the thing that actually solves their problem. Yes. It's like the sort of thing is like, who am I? And it's sort of like, who am I equals who are my parents? Where did I come from? Mm-hmm. The actual thing is, well, that's not who you are. Yeah. That's who they were, and that's not really the answer. And it boils down to me that, like, it's about what mattered to Rey.
Mm.
And I want to have things where I feel that the characters are not treating things. It feels a bit video gamey. If you'll indulge me, like, and I'm not trying to throw shade at people who do enjoy narratives of this type or exploring media in this way, but it's that sort of pseudo completionist aspect to it, which I think I feel like has come a bit from video game culture, where you can 100% an RPG or whatever, so you see all of the stories and all of the plot, and you know all of the things, and you've got all the weapons, and you've beaten all the guys, and you've done it. And it's a sense that, like, I have done this art now. And it's... I think that kind of has bled over from gaming as a popular medium to sometimes think about films, books, like TV series, is in a similar kind of way, that you want to do it to the point of having done it, you know, and explore all the aspects of it. And I'm not saying that's wrong, but I think that's kind of, for me, that kind of the mindset of that feels like similar, because I've never been completionist in terms of, like, I won't 100% a video game. I don't want to. I play video games until they stop being fun, and if that is at the end of the plot, great. If that is at the, you know, when I've 100%ed everything for some reason, then, like, great, you made a really fun video game. But I'm never compelled to go for that same completionist thing, which I know that you have on some occasions when you've got the bug or something, like, you know, with The Witness or with earlier Assassin's Creeds and stuff like that. You really knuckled into that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not gonna completely follow you on the suggestion that people are treating narratives like video games now. I think my interpretation of it is that, you know, people are always, with any narrative, people are searching for catharsis. That's how they work.
Yeah.
And I think just people, like, in the way that fan culture has evolved, especially now that we, you know, live in an internet age where you can get lots of information on the very granular details.
Mm. And discuss with similar like-minded people.
Yes. And then you get fan theories, and so people start inventing their own narratives that are secondary to the actual narrative, or
shipping. It's everywhere.
Yeah, and that sort of thing. And so then people start, I think, yeah, people just start, like, seeing, like, coming up with their own, like, ideas of plots that they would like, and then starting to expect them. Mm. And Steven Universe does have a long history of putting very small details in its show that actually point to later revelations, or really it's just that they had a very strong sense of their world and then hid certain details from Steven. And so, like, what I really enjoy about the first series is that, like, all, like, you can see that all the monsters have gems, and when they poof the monsters, they bubble the gems, and then the bubbles go anywhere, but nobody discusses that.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, first watching, so why are they doing that?
Yeah.
What are these monsters? And then it turns out that that gets revealed, like, oh yeah, that it's because they are actually gems, and there's a reason why we have to, and it is pointing to something that's happened that just hasn't been explained to Steven yet.
Yeah.
Which isn't a mystery per se, it's just that,
implication.
It was like environmental storytelling.
Yes.
It's just like they have built this world, and they put these details in to, because, oh, well, this is how this world works. And so they're showing you something without explaining it. And that I really enjoy. I can understand why, like, a lot of fans will say, like, look at my, like, tiny details and look for significance, because often the show has rewarded them for that.
Yeah. Get to feel like, aha, you get the aha, it comes back to the aha moment, yes.
Well, yeah.
You've created a mystery in a sense, and then solved it when the show justifies your theory.
Yeah, everyone likes being proven right, which is why it's always done when I think, oh, the fans have figured out our plot, quick, change it. It's like, no, they'll love it even more if you stick to your plan.
Yeah. Insert George R. R. Martin quote about the butler dude line absolutely. Here. Yeah, good advice.
But also, a thing I found out this week that I said to you at the time, and I loved finding this out, because it often bothers me that people... a lot of fans think that TV shows in particular are more planned than what they are. I get annoyed when people say about they didn't have a plan in Star Wars. It's like, well, even if they had the best plan in the world, Carrie Fisher would still have sadly passed away and they would have had to change it. Plans always change. You find out what the thing is as you're doing it.
Yeah.
So the thing I found out was that, so this is going to be a bit of a spoiler for, I think, series 3 or 4 of
Star Wars. I think we could, as long as we're not talking about the finale,
yeah,
I think
that's
fine.
If you're familiar with Steven Universe, you'll know that Steven has a pet lion, and his pet lion has a pocket dimension in his mane. If you weren't familiar with that, just go with it.
Watch Steven Universe, it's good.
It's a good show. And inside that pocket dimension are things that Steven's mother, Rose, had left behind. It turned out that there's a gem in a bubble in there, and later on in an episode called Bismuth, Stephen accidentally pops that bubble, the gem reforms, turns out that was a significant character in that bubble this whole time. So it seems like, oh, maybe they were sort of, here's Chekhov's gun, it's Chekhov's Bismuth.
Chekhov's gem.
Yes. what I found out... in the Steven Universe podcast, Joe Johnson, when he first designed the pocket dimension and put the various objects of Rose in there, including the chest, which turned out not to lead to a major plot point, but when he first designed the gem in a bubble, they didn't know it was Bismuth.
The character rather than Bismuth the gem. Yeah, it's a distinctive shape.
Yeah.
Because
it's
a Bismuth gem.
Yeah, but I don't. I'm not. They didn't know. They didn't have that character designed yet. They didn't have that plot in mind yet.
Yeah.
It was just a thing that. And that's the thing. Like, lots of creators, particularly in TV shows, when you have these sort of like, you take each series as it comes. Like, you plan a series at a time. Even if you have a 5-year plan, it's like, what does this series do? What does this series do? And you obviously a lot of way people work is that they, after they've done one series, they look back at details that they may leave details to be picked up later without knowing what's going to be picked up, or they might look at details that were just incidental at the time and try and go, oh, what's the significance of that? And Steven Universe has a lot of incredible continuity and some clear planning, but it was so gratifying for me to find out that, no, they do this as well. There's stuff at the start that they didn't know everything at the beginning.
Yeah.
And
well, the same thing with Adventure Time. Like, I've got the Adventure Time art book, and one of the things that's interesting in there is in one of the interviews with one of the creative team, they said when they were talking about this exact thing, because Adventure Time also has fiercely good internal consistency, and like stuff that seems inconsequential becomes significant later on. And they, when asked about like, did you plan all of this stuff, they were like, no, we treat our writing sessions kind of like D&D. Like, we will literally just sort of role play out the stuff and come up with like loose outlines based on the sort of what we think would be a fun interaction based on this, that, the other. And then another example is Venture Brothers, where Venture Brothers, the best internal continuity in the business, like, flatly. Like, they have done things and brought back stuff where it's like, this was a throwaway joke in season 1, episode 4, and then, like, 7 seasons later, this pays off and was actually a whole thing, and you're like, what? And again, when asked about that, they go, well, no, we only ever work on a per-season basis, and we have the idea of, we know where we're starting off, and we know where we want to go, and then we kind of work our way to meet in the middle of sort of planning out what we're going to do, and then we sort of look at what we've already done and think, well, could we work this in in this particular place?
And that's a skill in and of itself. What's this made me realise is that I think I think part of the reason why I do sort of favour these sort of like puzzle box narratives is because I just remember these details. Like I can see these like very specific like one-off lines. I remember dialogue and stuff very easily. With that,
you've got a good memory for it.
Yeah, I absorb this sort of stuff, and so that means I notice more easily when a show contradicts itself. And so I love it when a throwaway thing still like informs the world. A really good example is 30 Rock. There's a joke in that where Jenna is doing an interview with Barbara Walters, or at least an impersonation of Barbara Walters by Rachel Dratch, and the whole interview is just a joke on this Barbara Walters impression, where she says a big sentence where everything rhymes. Your father Werner was a burger server in suburban Santa Barbara, where he spurned your mother Werner for a curly-haired surfer named Roberto. Did that hurt her? There we go.
You just had to get that in that you know.
He
says, I have a really good memory for dialogue and then control. Let me talk about this example when I can give an example of my skills.
I need to mention the example because the point is, later on in the series, Jenna's mother is introduced. And this was a throwaway gag that named both her parents.
Yeah.
And it was just a joke about Barbara Walters. But because she said that, and Jenna plays it straight as if, like, this isn't a joke, this
is
real.
I'll always be his little girl.
Yeah. Then all of a sudden, Jenna... for Jenna, it is true.
Yeah.
And so when they introduce the characters later, the fact that they remember that that they made this joke, and also that they don't then decide, oh, that was just a throwaway joke, let's actually take this seriously now.
It makes the world richer.
Yeah,
and
now
more texture.
Yeah, so now I think that's a lot of what I enjoyed about that element of Steven Universe, is that like there are details here pointing at the wider world that reward you when you look into them. And so that's why I enjoyed that so much, because it's like, oh, there's so much more world here than there is on the surface.
Mm. I think I've been thinking about how I think about world building recently, and just like what I really appreciate from world stuff, you know, and just like because I think if you'd asked me about it, like, you know, maybe like a couple of years ago, I would have been like, oh, I'm all about world building. I love a really rich world. And like, I don't care about having a rich and well realized world that's believable and stuff. But I think in a way I've come to care less about that. I'm not entirely sure why. Like, I did the thing recently. I recently did a reread of Gunner Creek Course. Which is great. It's a great comic. Really good. Like, I'm rereading, I was just like, fuck, this is good. Holy shit. Like, it does an awful lot with actually comparatively quite a little. Like, I found it really interesting just going back and rereading stuff and being like, oh man, like, they don't really explain a lot of this stuff. It's very interested in the idea of not necessarily presenting mystery, but just not really getting bogged down in necessarily the specifics of what this particular thing is and how it functions. Like, particularly with the introduction of, like, Zimmy as a character. Like, the chapter where you meet Zimmy is, like, it's like a full circle thing where it's sort of like a little micro-narrative that joins onto the beginning at the end. It begins at the end and ends at the beginning, rather. And it's almost dialogue-less, and it's all from Zimmy's perspective, and it's weird, and it's confusing, and it's got all these weird dreamlike elements that just come together. And it doesn't explain any of it. But then as the things go on, as we see Zimmy do more stuff, we get a greater idea of what she's capable of. But it's still they've never had a moment where anyone sat down and said, well, this is what blah, blah, blah is. Or, like, equally with, like, Jones, like, you know, with the who am I thing, and we just see her throughout history in that way, and it doesn't tell you. It's just like, well, this is what it is, and you're left to draw more of your own conclusions from it, I guess. And it's a very specific balance, because, like, one of the reasons I've never really necessarily got on with, like, Trek, for example, like, Star Trek to me has always been like, it's fair to say that Star Trek by and large is fairly dry.
Yes.
As, you know, in the grand scheme of, like, sci-fi stuff.
I'm agreeing with you in, like, I have engaged with Star Trek slightly more than you, in that I have seen a fair bit of Voyager. It's the best one, don't at me.
I watched, for my own Star Trek experience, I watched a fair amount of The Next Generation, a bit of Voyager here and there, and like a couple of episodes of Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
You know, but it was always because it was on. It wasn't a thing that I actively pursued.
Yeah.
But it was always like, you know, Star Trek is just political drama in space.
Yes.
And there comes a point where it's very much, as you see it mutate from original Trek into Next Generation Trek into Voyager Trek, there's always the sort of stuff of like the technobabble and like the richness and the serial numbers and all that kind of stuff, which really just doesn't interest me. And it's that kind of thing where part of the attraction of Trek, and again, I'm not saying this is a bad thing, this is one of the things that I don't like, is it is interested in providing a very sort of forensic scientific look at the worlds it's creating. It's always like, oh, well, this is the Romulans, and this is who they are, and this is their big machine that does this, that, the other, and here's today's confusing thing that we'll find out the scientific reason for by the end of the episode, because it's about that journey of the Trek characters discovering strange new worlds and learning about them and codifying them to a certain extent. Whereas something like Gunnar Krieg, it does have... a lot of that story is about the tension between Kat as the person who wants to codify and understand and mechanize everything that she encounters, and Annie, who is more happy to exist in a more emotional, like, unformed, freer sense in a way. But again, Kat's thing isn't necessarily restrictive, but it's order versus chaos. And I think that kind of binary is much more... I definitely feel I fall more on the chaos end of the spectrum, that I'm more drawn to like chaotic narratives where it's less about like, you can find out all the things about this thing, whereas you can more bathe in the atmosphere, perhaps. I'm trying to find the right language because I don't want to sound like I'm being pejorative of people who do enjoy that very micro view of stuff, but it's an interesting tension because, I mean, I've, you know, in the worlds I've created and stuff for like stuff that I've made, I've tried to be quite specific and thought carefully about how things work because, like, I'm like, well, I should know.
Yeah.
But then I look at, like, stuff that you've created and I've looked at the stuff that other people I know have written and made and I'm just like, oh, I'm not doing very much at all. Like, I get to a certain point and go, that's good enough, that's good enough.
Yeah, but it's interesting because I've sort of had the same experience looking at your writing.
Oh, really?
Which is that, like, as you said before, like, you at least used to have a much... stronger preference for world building, whereas in the past I've always, like, I would structure a narrative around the characters and then structure the world based on what suits the characters best. I sort of have a view of the narrative in my mind first and then fit the world around that, because I rarely approach it from the other perspective, in that, like, I will build a world and then fit my narrative into it. I'm working on another draft of the fantasy novel that I've finished like four or five times now.
It's good. I mean, it's good.
It's getting there. But the way I've definitely approached it this time is to try and just create a greater sense of the world. I have put a lot more effort into world building than I usually do. And I'm finding that, that raised certain questions that I hadn't considered before. And it made me, like, sort of realize the mindset of the characters a bit more, and also, like, what my villain's goal would be, rather than just, like, sort of something a bit more vague.
He's going to do a fascism.
Yeah.
But
I was like, well, in this world, this is what he would want, because that's what's important in the way that this world has evolved.
This is what the value is.
Yeah.
Whereas, I think I've gone the opposite direction. Like, I've started running more in the direction of full out just like metaphor, mythology, allegory, and non-literalized settings as a way of, like, I get bogged down in the world building, you know, or at least I find I get bogged down in the technical perspectives of the world building, and that impacts my characters. So I'm like, okay, what if I just start working in a space that is much more reactive to the characters and is less worried about the idea of how all of this fits together? Because if you set your narrative in an undersea of chaotic magic, you could just get away with shit like that. And it's more about, like, the specific character moments. Yeah. So I'm thinking more in terms of, again, it comes back to that idea of, like, emotional momentum. And, like, how do I keep the momentum up and the momentum going to hold not only my interest, but also a prospective reader's interest. Because I know if I lose interest in characters, I'm just like, well, fuck it. Throw it all away. You know, I'll come up with something else. You know, I'm very capricious in that sense, I suppose. I was going to do a sidebar to a topic earlier. Shipping.
Okay.
Is this a thing that you still do? Or did still. Previously?
Not really.
Yeah. Did you ever get into it in a big way at all?
No. If I've ever shipped anyone, it's like maybe it's the sort of queer ships that would never happen. So I've never gotten invested in a ship.
My whole experience of
Digimon. But also, I do find shipping a bit, I don't think it's a bad thing to do, or... No. What I find odd about it is when people start expecting a certain ship to be canonized. Mm. Because generally I think narratives do a pretty good job of telegraphing who their romantic leads are.
Yeah.
And either those two get together or maybe they subvert it rarely. And so shipping, yeah, it seems a bit odd that you become invested in a certain ship which might not be telegraphed by the narrative very hard, but might be interesting in its own right. But then to sort of think, oh, this is where the narrative should go. It's like, but at the end of the day, when a narrative finishes, it always looks back at how it began, and the relationship it sets up first is always going to be the more narratively weighty. Yeah. I remember a tweet I saw, I think it was Lindsay Ellis. Talking about how she was comparing two narratives. I forget what the other one was, but it was the point in how what was important, what Hamilton did very well, is that even though chronologically Hamilton approached Angelica romantically first and then got with Eliza, the way it structured its narrative is that it showed you Hamilton meeting Eliza first before revealing that Angelica
previously, yeah.
Because Eliza is the one he ends up, so is the more like significant romantic
long term kind of thing. Yeah.
So you put that one first because that is the end game, and that's how you communicate to an audience that this is like I'm going to raise this expectation for you because this is where we're going.
Yeah.
And if you raise the expectation of Angelica first for the whole narrative, you're like, when's he going to get with Angelica?
Yeah. And I won't lie, I've often thought, I was just like, man, I know that it's always one of those things that obviously Hamilton, not really that interested in the sort of, you know, the relationship goings on, because it's more about the formation of a nation, etc. But there have been moments, usually like, you know, shower time, when you're not really focusing on anything, and I'm just all like, it is, you know, kind of a shame that, like, Angelica and Hamilton always seem to get each other more. And that's kind of the tragedy of it. And I was like, oh, I guess that's the point.
Yeah.
That it's that's the dramatic tension. I was just like, oh, yeah. But I was thinking about shipping because it comes back to that thing of, like you say, projecting a sense of expectation.
Yeah.
I actually watched a very interesting video today, as it happens, which came out today, which was by Curio, which was about, it was entitled Immersion or What Do Video Games Owe Us? And it was talking about the sort of, again, it comes back to this idea of expectation of a person consuming a piece of media. Mm. And he contextualized it quite effectively. It's a good video. You should check it out.
Okay.
It's like 25 minutes long. It talks about like Death Stranding and Witcher and stuff like that. And other things where immersion is considered a sort of a laudable quality. But then he sort of unpacks, well, what does immersion actually mean in terms of video games? Like, you know, what is a reasonable expectation and stuff? And, you know, some people say invisible walls are immersion breaking. And you're just like, well, yes, but also why... They can't not have those because they need to keep you focused on the thing that the game is trying to immerse you in.
That's
no,
fine. We'll all
narrative.
Just live on a very square shaped island in the middle of an endless sea.
Is this Animal Crossing?
No, it's Grand Theft Auto. But no, you're right. It's Animal Crossing as well.
But yeah, and it was the idea of one of the things that shipping does is that I occasionally, you know, in the nerd forums that I hang out on, I'll see people speaking in ways which I'm never necessarily sure how serious they are, but they'll project an air of being quite territorial and quite serious about like the ships that they have in, you know, stuff like My Hero Academia, which, you know, I just want to say My Hero Academia, it's fine, but I just want to say it is just fine. It's stunningly mediocre with exceptionally good moments of hype. Mm. Otherwise, it's a solid 6, which occasionally jumps to a 9 for like 2 scenes, and then we'll plummet back down to a 6 of being just like fine in terms of my engagement and enjoyment of it. It's not a thing that I really think is like high, amazing stuff. But it was interesting to see a lot of people who really like it were talking about, oh, I really love the whole shipping aspect. They were talking about, I'm really into this couple. And I was just like, but that's the thing that made me kind of wrinkle my brain a little. So I was just like, but that's not what this series is about. And you know it's not what this series is about. This series is a very traditional battle manga about one young man's journey to become a good hero boy. And, you know, he makes a lot of colourful friends and maybe has some of his preconceptions about heroic society and what it means to do the right thing. It's about that journey. And it's very not interested in romance, especially not for its primary cast members, because they're all young teens who, let's face it, young teens, they're never interested in sex having in any real capacity. Am I right, fellas? Sometimes, I swear to God, sometimes, like, the lack of horniness in some manga, I'm just like, I feel like they'd be dating more. What? They should be dating more. Go on dates.
There's an episode of Sabrina the Teenage Witch where Sabrina is going on like a beach holiday with her friends, and her aunts are concerned that she's going to have a horny time. They don't say that, but that is what they're concerned about. And so they cast a spell so she'll have good, clean fun, and then it turns into a musical. It's like summer holiday style story, and like Sabrina's fully aware of it. It's just like, oh,
that's amazing. That's great.
It's a really good
story. But it's the thing, it's like people get interested in these romantic entanglements that, from my perspective, from my reading of the text, exist on like the most minuscule level. It's like, oh, that character looked at that character in that scene and maybe blushed slightly. And then we did like an entire arc about fighting a Godzilla or whatever. And I'm like, well, you can see in terms of the amount of attention that these things are receiving, that there's a clear, you're never going to get, it comes back to the thing, like, you're never going to be satisfied by this.
Yeah.
Because,
you've made an interpretation that may or may not be the intent.
Yeah.
And it might be an interpretation you like, but you still have to be aware that that's all it is. It's an interpretation. And that doesn't mean you've been promised that, or that it doesn't mean that that is a narrative expectation that has necessarily been raised or telegraphed.
Yeah, like one of the classic examples from, because we were the age where this mattered at the time, Harry Potter.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I remember having a conversation with my mum where she was like, oh, and I saw, when she was always a few books behind me and my sister, and she was like, oh, I can see a bit of like romance between Harry and Hermione, maybe. And then me and my sister immediately went, no! Ron and Hermione!
How dare you, Mum? God!
And this was like, not even before like book 7 had come out. Like, it was like, we knew that's what the pairing was.
Yeah.
And any suggestion that wasn't the pairing was dumb.
Yeah.
Because we were shitty teens.
Yeah, but equally, one of my key things I remember about like the whole shipping thing is I was just like, man, I'll tell you, I did ship. I was thinking, like, I think Harry and Luna should end up together.
Mm.
They both had non-standard childhoods. They're both kind of like outsiders to society. They do seem to actively have common ground because they both seen people get killed in front of them.
And Luna does also seem like, even more, perhaps more so than Hermione and Ron, to be like completely uninterested in Harry's fame. Like, it does not affect how she relates to him at all.
Yeah. And I was like, that seems healthy and good. And then we have the introduction of the worst character in the series, which is Ginny Weasley. Who, I don't want to say, like, I hate her, but I'm just like, she just, my attention and interest in her just slid off. It was like, water off a duck's back.
I like that she's a good Quidditch player.
Is she? I honestly
had, I don't know. I don't know if we've seen, I'm not sure we've been shown that so much as we've been told that. I think was she on the Gryffindor team at some point?
Probably. Yeah. Everyone was, you know. Eventually.
I remember there was a lot of Quidditch in Half-Blood Prince that like did not make it into the film at all.
Yeah. Well, it was Ron became,
oh wait, no, yes it was. It
wasn't
film,
Ron,
sorry,
the keeper.
Yeah, that's the thing. That was it
was a massive plot in the book, and then it was like a montage in the movie.
That's the thing, even in that story in Half-Blood Prince, like Ron was the important thing about that story. And that, I guess that makes sense because like Ron is a more, in the hierarchy of characters, Ron is higher up than Ginny is.
Yes.
But it does mean that maybe Ginny's not a particularly interesting love interest.
Well, the thing that I found is that the thing I couldn't get past is I just didn't believe the relationship between Ginny and Harry.
Mm.
The reason my shipping for me was triggered, I'm going to link it back here, The reason why I started projecting something that gave me a sense of, like, this is what I think the narrative should do, is because the narrative started doing something. I just, like, I don't feel this is internally consistent. Like, I don't believe this. You can, you know, you've put these two chairs on top of each other and said, look, a marriage. And I'm like, I don't, that's not what that is. There was, for me at least, no chemistry. There was no actual believable, like, you know, we have feelings for each other. It was just like, it felt like the narrative was pushing this towards me.
I think the reason that Ginny was the choice is because of the interesting dramatic tension that raises in Harry's relationship with Ron, in that, you know, Ron has been shown to be quite territorial of his sister and her relationships. And so that puts Harry in an interesting position regarding his friendship with Ron when he starts having feelings for his sister.
Yeah, for like 5 minutes.
Yeah, and so... so, like, I agree with you. Like, they... I don't think they do have a lot of chemistry, but I can see, like, oh, that's the reason, is because of these, like, Ginny really only exists to create drama between Harry and Ron, not to create drama between Harry and Ginny.
Or to create a satisfying resolution to the Harry potential love interest plot.
Well, they see the satisfying resolution is when they accidentally kiss in the celebration after winning the Gryffindor, like, well, after winning, I think, the whole Quidditch World Cup, where they're all, like, really happy, and Harry kisses Ginny without thinking about it, and then looks at Ron, is like, oh, fuck, and Ron just nods, and I think that, like, so that's...
And Ron's like, yeah, you go nod my sister, mate.
And I think,
fucking
so
love it.
I think that's the point, is that the culmination of, at least in Half-Blood Prince, the romantic story for Harry there, the culmination is Ron accepting it, not I've kissed Ginny.
Yeah, and not, like, there was never any discussion. I see, I'm finally starting to understand, like, that dumb fucking post on Tumblr. We're like, well, we didn't get to see blah.
Okay, so Nick is...
I'm not going to put people on blast. No, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it.
There was a certain... I'll speak about it in vague terms. There was a post on Tumblr of people... Of someone complaining about the Steven Universe finale, like, saying, like, reasons why it didn't work. And Nick's response to it was, did you see the show?
I was like, did you watch the fucking show?
Yeah.
Because it felt like that this person... had understood the emotional arc of the series, but didn't realize that they were at the end. I think is the kindest way to say it. Other than they're just a dumb piss baby who doesn't understand narrative.
But that's like we discussed at the time as well. Like, there's always going to be a certain subset of your audience who are not engaging with your story in the way that you intended them to. The example I get, like, particularly with satire, like, if you do any satire, there is going to be a portion of people who don't understand it as satire and take it literally.
This is Poe's law.
Yeah.
I suppose it may be in that way that I think, for me at least, the only time I start... Well, I mean, I don't really do it at all now these days.
Do what?
Like, to come back to the shipping and the whole sort of projecting an idea of what the narrative necessarily should be. I think I've gotten to a point now that generally I'm sort of just like, well, I want to see what you're going to do. And then it happens and I go, yeah, I think that works. Yeah. Or I go, that didn't really work for me. It's less... You know, obviously this is the thing that only really occurs with, like, series stuff where you're... waiting for the next thing to come out so you have that space for speculation. And it's like, you know, I'm reading a ton of comics, for example. I'm reading a shitload of manga. Like, take One Piece, for example. It's always
Must I? Oh, there's a lot of it. It's so heavy.
It's so good, though. It's so good.
Why did you hand them all to me?
It's weird. But, One Piece is going to end at some point when I'm old and grey. Probably, maybe, I hope. Do I have projections about how it ends? I'm like, not really. Do I have strong opinions about where the characters are going or are going to go? Not really. I'm enjoying the journey. I like these characters. I like the things that have been done with them so far. Like, I've got, like, maybe vague speculations. Been like, well, I guess that Luffy will probably beat up the baddie at some point. Like, that's a prediction. But
so that's the thing, because I do stuff like that. And that, like, I get, because of the way my brain works, and maybe because I'm a writer myself, is that I can't engage with any narrative without, like, sort of trying to unpack it as we go. And that, like, oh, where are we going with this? What's going to happen? But I think it's only in the sense that of like of what is that I pick up on what narrative expectations the narrative is raising.
Yeah.
And not necessarily potential ones that that might be interesting but isn't specifically saying this is what's going to happen. And just because I think a lot about how narratives work, is that I understand very clearly, okay, so you've raised this up. The catharsis of this would be something like this. I remember while watching Knives Out, which is a puzzle box mystery.
And really liked it, as I recall.
I did really like it, but especially, but there was a bit, like, without spoiling it, it takes a bit of a swerve. Ooh. At the end of the first act.
A zig.
And it goes, oh, okay, this is not where I was expecting it to go. Mm-hmm. But then, and whilst that was all very interesting, the whole time I was like, yeah, but you still got to do this. And I was still figured like you've made us think that you're not going to do this, but you still have to for the narrative to have that catharsis.
And did it do that?
It did do that. And that's the thing. But the whole and there was a sort of tension in me whilst watching the second act, where I was just like, okay, this is fun. I'm enjoying it. But you better do this.
You don't fuck it up. Because you stick the landing now.
Because this is the narrative expectation you raised, and you have to deliver on that because that is how narratives work. And I say that as if like that is like as if there is one specific way that narratives can work.
Hmm.
I know the conventions and I subscribe to them in many ways, but I'm also of the opinion that if something defies convention and it works, then that's fine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially because convention is, you know, defined by what we write anyway.
Yeah, it's interesting because I don't think I used to do that a lot more. And I think, I don't know what changed, but at some point I think it's not necessarily, because sometimes people will say like, oh, you overthink stuff to me. Because I can talk about, like, you know, for example, I went to see the musical Come From Away, mm-hmm. with a bunch of work friends, which is a musical. It's fine. what I say is the performances are very good, the live music is great, the songs are pretty catchy. The actual plot itself for me just didn't quite land, because it's a play that is effectively loosely about 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, it wants to be a fun, happy, here we go, look at these fun, you know, these star-crossed lovers meeting in, you know, Newfoundland and falling in love, and he's British and she's from Texas, and they've got different things, but also 9/11. And it's like, it's a sense of tonal whiplash where they want to be able to have the heavy weights, real emotional catharsis from a genuine real world tragedy that happened in our lifetime. Like, you know, I literally remember this happening. And they also want to have their fun thing. And I'm like, there probably is a way to square that particular circle.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel this play does it. So when we came out, all my friends said, oh, I thought it was so lovely. And I cried. I thought it was really good. And I was like, and I said words to that effect. And they went, what? And I was like, yeah, that's what I thought of it. They're like, but we only just... How do you have such a... It's a musical! And there was this sense of, like...
Sorry, that is a justification.
Well, yeah, you know what I mean. But it's like... and I'm not, like, trying to have a crack at my co-workers or whatever. But the thing of it was is that the assumption that I would have that level of reasonably complex contextualizing and thought about the structure of it was not considered the standard.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've actively tried to move away from that. I think I still am quite analytical about things that I consume. Mm. But there's a lot of things now that it's not that I care less. Like, take Kimetsu no Yaiba, for example. Demon Slayer. Okay. Fucking fantastic. It's one of my favorite series that's running right now. The most recent arc has been, like, a multi-stage, crazy final boss fight thing. And it's been insane. Like, it surprised me in the sense I was just like, we're doing this? Oh, fuck, it's all oh, God! And, like, you know, no one is safe. Mm-hmm. Like, I read chapters and I'm fucking like, I don't know who's gonna live. Everyone has been maimed. And there's blood on the walls. Everything's on fire. Conceptually, I'm not talking about specifics, but, you know, it's been a very, like, we're just gonna play all of the hands. You know, like, every card that I could conceivably think of that has been left yet to play in the manga is being played right the fuck now. And it's brilliant. Am I thinking about, well, where's all this going? You know, I'm not trying to predict it. I'm very much just like swept along by that. I read a chapter and I go, fuck, that was awesome.
Yeah.
Holy shit. And then I go back and read it again immediately because I'm just like, oh my God, this is so good and powerful and earned and really dealing with the hard-edged, you know, fucking terrifying, but also really fun aspects of all of this thing. And I'm like, I can unpack it, and I could probably predict some things that are going to happen. But it does not leap to mind. I don't care about the structure of it. I'm just like, I like this. I think my pleasure center has grown to such a point. It's just like, no, I want it. Not that trying to unpack it would make my enjoyment less. Yeah. It's just, I don't feel compelled to.
Yeah, the only time where I can kind of do that, and because I do find that part of my brain quite difficult to turn off. And I've actually had the exact same experience of you going to see Waitress with my family, where after we come out and I say, like, hey, isn't it interesting that, like, most of the main character, the main cast, like, their stories were clearly thematically linked, and that they were all women who were in, like, suffocating relationships with men who, like, disempower them because they are women, except for one of the characters who seemed to have a good relationship with a man who stalked her at work and sung a song that was called "I love you and means you're never, ever, 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 ever getting rid of me."
Oh boy.
And yet that was meant to be a good thing. I was like, well, really? Oh, I didn't really think. So yeah, I've had the exact same experience. But yeah, the only time I can ever really sort of switch off that analytical part of my brain is watching Doctor Who, because that is something I want to enjoy.
See, this is interesting. And I'm aware we've only got like 6 minutes of recording time left, but we seem to have ambled over to an interesting topic. One of the things I want to say is that sometimes people do ask me, don't you find it makes things difficult to enjoy when you do the analytical thing? And I'm like, no. Like, you know, I've talked a certain amount about how I'm very much tied to emotional momentum in a piece. And it's like, you know, I should say the thing that I said that was deliberate. I haven't figured out a way to get it in, but I'm just going to say, it's the Chad melodrama versus the Virgin mystery. you know, that's what I wanted to say. Like, so I skew more towards enjoying melodrama because it just runs on emotion. And you can analyse melodrama.
Yeah.
And, like, you can analyse, you know, like, fucking looking around. Like, Octopus Pie, for example. Fantastic comic. Brilliant comic. I think that Meredith Grand, the writer of that, is doing at the moment is she is reposting the comic, and that's already finished and has been published. I have all the books; it's all online anyway. But she's been reposting it and doing effectively, you know, director's commentary, and that has been fascinating because reading that, I'm like, oh, this is your process, and I'm like, oh, some of the things that I thought about the analysis that I did of this as it was happening totally paid off, and for me, that was the analysis was part of it. You know, it's very much the kind of thing that I was just like, no, I want to analyze this, and I want to pick up on all these little tiny themes and bits and pieces and like small tiny granular stuff, and I was just like, oh, neat.
Well, I always get really interested in like the way things, like, oh, how is this making me react in this way? Because you mentioned before, like, sometimes if there's a thing I really like, I might watch it a few times in that sort of obsessive, like, borderline autism way. I've checked my symptoms. I'm but I think the reason I do that is partly because, you know, I'm trying to reconnect with what I felt at the time.
Yeah. Chasing the high.
But also like trying to, like, I'm looking at it being like, how did you do that? How did you like make me react in that specific way?
I definitely do that as well. Like, not as much as you do, but like, there are key things that I know if I, you know, usually it's things that will give me a very, very strong emotional reaction. Like, you know, to Kimetsu no Yaiba, there's the big cathartic bit in this where, like, you know, he activates his special hidden power and he's like, I've got to do this. And I'm like, oh, man, he's going to do it. And the music's all like, oh, no, no. And then his sister's all like, I've got to save you from yourself. And I was like, ah, these siblings love each other so much. And they've all they got in the world. I love it. It's good, and I'm just like, oh, and I in the same way, I've looked at, like, man, it's really good that this is such a powerful moment. I mean, in some ways, it's a little scary, like, when you have something that really fucking hits you emotionally, like, there's an element to that I think is inherently quite scary, because it's a piece of media or text or film or whatever that can hit you somewhere so vulnerable and powerful that it's like, oh, it's the stuff that, like, you know, that's what I think, like, as creators, you know, we're all chasing in some way. Like, I'd love it if the thing that I wrote could do what that sequence of Demon Slayer does for me to someone else. I would love to have the... I would just love to know that someone, like, thought that this really got me. And I'd be like, yeah! That's what I want to do! I want to get you emotionally with my emotional momentum! And all my shitty teens in their conceptual magical world! I hate my parents, but my parents are dead! And the state is my mom and stuff! Capitalism! Sorry, I got into just, again, just rambling there. Mm. But yeah, so with 2 minutes to go...
So what was this about?
This was... I think it's about just media interpretation. Shocker for this podcast. Yeah. Who knows? We've definitely spoken about this before.
Interpretation and expectation.
Yeah, and also, like, but the balance between order and chaos with regards... Yeah. Or rather to mechanical cleanliness versus emotional... momentum.
Yeah,
I think, you know, that seems to be the thing.
I think both are important.
Both are good.
But yeah, it depends. What, like, you can value them differently in different ways, and you can prioritize them differently.
Yeah, like I hate mysteries. Like, yeah, what? Yeah. I really don't get on with mysteries because, as you've said before, the fun of the mystery for you is trying to figure out the thing.
Yeah. And whereas, even not necessarily because. The fun is trying to figure it out so long as you don't actually figure it out. It is always very nice to be surprised.
This is the thing, whereas I read a mystery, I'm just like, oh, I wonder who did it. And that's as far as it goes.
I think in any narrative, I just get on board whenever it raises a question that doesn't have an immediate, like, he's dead, but the room was locked and he was the only one inside. That just makes me go, oh.
And there was a bucket of water on the floor. And you're like, what does that mean?
Yeah, like stuff like that. And then when you get these little, like, it's whenever you get like a collection of stuff that doesn't quite make sense.
You want to instill order on that sense.
And so long as there is the narrative promise that it will make sense. And that's what I like. It's like there is a sense here to be found.
Mm. Have you ever watched Twin Peaks?
I've seen the odd episode, I've done a lesson on it, and I don't think that would satisfy me in the same way.
I was going to say, yeah, because I know a lot of people get very weird about, like, you know, my dad used to get real weird about Twin Peaks, and I know a lot of people got very weird about it, and I think it's like the antithesis of what we've described there.
Well, that's the thing, it's, in my last 5 seconds, it's like, it's what turned me off Battlestar Galactica in the end, because one thing I was really intrigued, there goes the time, I'll sum up my thought. In Battlestar Galactica is that here's a character who can see a Cylon that only he can see, and why is that? But he's not a Cylon. What does that mean?
That's cool.
And I was so intrigued by that. And then, but when we got to season 4, I gave up when I realized, oh, you don't know either. And there may be no answer to this question. And even if you do answer this question, it's probably not going to fit with all the twists and turns you put in, because you put them in just to be twists and turns. You're not actually trying to reveal a truth that you knew from the beginning.
Tell you what, you know, a small thing I'll just say just right at the end. You know a show that does basically that plot line but actually executes on it pretty well? Bravest Warriors? They have the concierge that only select people can see him, and they do reveal kind of
the concierge is one of the things that we go, ooh,
yeah,
who is that? Where's he from? Questions.
Who does his hair? Jim, I think we successfully wasted some time, some quarren time. Stay safe, folks.
Yeah, stay
safe.
Practice
social distancing.
And if you take anything from this podcast, if there's something that you want to watch whilst you're in quarantine, Steven Universe is a great show.
Oh, Steven Universe is fucking great.
Yeah, don't watch it on Netflix because they're missing some of the seasons. Some of the episodes are out of order. See if you can find a streaming site or something. Or maybe order a DVD. It's fine.
Yeah, get them DVDs. Support the show.
Yeah.
Wicker.
Yeah.
I didn't have an exit.
What a waste of time. There we go. What a Waste of Time featured the voices of me, Jim Woodall, and Nick Hurd. Music by Anthony Bullinger.